this is Michael Gerson with Mr. Steve Henry for the Mutual Defense Agreement Project. To begin with, they wanted to get your career to date on tape. That's the first question I'm supposed to ask. So if you wouldn't, starting there, please, sir.
Okay. Steve Henry. I really started this in 1975, 1976, when I entered into the United States Army. And my career background from the beginning has been in the field artillery, which was nuclear. And initially started out with the 8-inch atomic projectile training for assembly and for operational use if required. And so I've done that for about 21 years. Field artillery the whole time, but I've also been operations, nuclear operations research and development with the Department of the Army and also with the Department of Energy. Been involved with the UK since about 1995. But some earlier, as far as the Mutual Defense Agreement, but also participated with the UK from 1988 to 1991.
In what capacity was that in your early interactions from 1998? Were you still in the Army at that point?
I was still in the Army at that point. I was a with the Inspector General Corps, and my job was operations officer and team chief for conducting nuclear surety inspections, for which the UK and the US jointly participated in exercises and custody and technical operations, and I was an inspector of those joint operations.
How do you characterize, from both a political and a technical perspective, this U.S.-UK mutual relationship, this special relationship between the two countries? It's been going on for a number of years, and we've had a chance to speak to people, some admirals in charge of strategic systems programming, and get a sense for that real ground level. How would you characterize the extent of the cooperation in terms of civility, personal relationships? How close is this working relationship? What are your thoughts on how this relationship has evolved over time?
Well, I'll do that from both aspects. First off, as the Inspector General, the U.S. unit that was assigned to a British artillery unit, that relationship was extremely close. They depended on each other day in and day out, both for support, technical operations, to include community support in those areas. And I found that a very good atmosphere for which the U.S. and the U.K. did an interface. I think it was very mutually beneficial to both sides. From the perspective of once I got to Department of Energy and I did the interface really as part of the Mutual Defense Agreement on working on the warhead side, I've been very impressed with the level of cooperation, the level of exchange between both nations, both on operations and technical. And so I think those systems or those relationships are very closely tied and mutually beneficial to both parties. I think we learn a lot from each other on these exchanges. And the exchanges are both in technical operations of the warhead, the safety, security, control of the warhead itself, the transportation of the warhead, the operations of the warhead, and also on the delivery platforms, maintenance and operations of that platform. And in all cases, I think both parties have learned from each other and how to leverage our resources and take advantage of each nation's strengths, that really has helped both on both sides.
That's interesting. It's one of the things we've been trying to draw out as I've been thinking about this is mm-hmm. we tend to think of this, certainly in 58, as the U.S. helping the U.K. But as it seems, as you've indicated, over time, this has been a really, the U.S. has benefited from this relationship, in addition to just providing early on another leg of deterrent and another component of of the nuclear relationship. What are some of the ways in which you've interacted with them on the technical side? We're talking, I guess, about in the 90s, the development of Trident.
No, in the mid-1990s, my direct interface was as a member of the Department of Energy. And we were developing the life extension programs for the different weapon systems, a program which has actually never been done before. Historically, systems both on U.S. and the U.K., weapon systems were developed. They were certified. They were fielded to the military. They stayed in the hands of the military for nominally about 20 years, at which time they were retired and replaced with new systems. For the U.S., and really for the U.K., all the production for warhead development ended in the early 1990-1991 timeframe. And so the real question is, how do you continue to maintain confidence in the weapon system that is going to last longer than it was ever expected to in its initial planning? Part of the reason I was hired by the Department of Energy was to take a look as to, could you extend the life of the weapon systems? As part of that, we also did exchanges with UK to find out what kind of information did they know through their surveillance program, what kind of concerns did they have with their own unique weapon systems, that would help us learn and make decisions as to what kind of components would we replace and at what time would we replace those components. So we entered into a cooperation with UK looking at life extension itself for the different warheads. We entered into a program of sharing information for the enhanced surveillance program. And we also looked at more innovative ways of being able to do production so that we could gain efficiencies. And so I think that was a critical piece of exchange as well, and it continues to be that, particularly in light of us having to certify our stockpiles without underground nuclear testing.
So the platform at this point, the UK was still working with the Polaris. Was this life extension for that system? Which
no, it's
platform?
For Trident.
This is okay. So we're talking
for
about
Trident.
Life extension
no,
for Trident. Okay.
I just look old.
Mitchell, Director of SP, was talking about, you know, coming to redeveloping some of the motor, actually developing old technology to extend the life of the A3.
Mm-hmm. I know Admiral Mitchell. I actually was in during the time of Polaris, but by the time I got to the Department of Energy, we'd already converted over to Trident.
Where were you during with the transition from Polaris to Poseidon?
Polaris to Trident. I was in Europe. And I was part of the NATO targeting cell as well, and we interfaced with the UK then, and we helped out for the targeting of Polaris back in the 80s.
How much, in terms of both the historical evolution of this cooperation during the Cold War and today, how much cooperation is going on in terms of targeting, in terms of operations? My question is how integrated, outside of the technical aspect, from a strategy and doctrine perspective, how integrated were the programs? Did we spend a lot of time speaking with the UK about integrating in terms of NATO forces, which targets we would cover, which targets they would cover? Were those largely kept separate?
In the time frame for which we're talking that we were doing that, that was in the 80s that I had experience in. That was fully integrated into the targeting packages that NATO was developing in case of war. And the UK dedicated some number of weapon systems to the NATO war plans. And all of that had to be deconflicted with what the UK would do and what the U.S. would do in support of NATO. So all those did go into the target planning considerations and deconfliction.
In your work at that point, did you have a sense for how Did the UK view this as a truly independent deterrent that provided them, certainly did provide them a seat at the table as a member of this sort of small nuclear club, but how much, from your view, did they act independently and want to think about deterrence issues and strategy issues independently, or did we have a significant influence on their thinking and almost subtly, in a subtle way, sort of push them in certain ways to cover certain targets as to think about deterrence in certain ways?
Well, at the strategic level, I really can't answer that question, but at the tactical and operational level, I think that we did that as a partnership. Not just the U.S. and the U.K., but NATO as a whole, and that there was NATO targets that were being developed, looked at, and a determination on how would you engage those. And the analysis of those targets really went into what weapon system could best engage those targets. And so I think that was a cooperative effort, and there was that time, period of time in the 80s where you had a lot of folks that understood the intricacies of target planning, deconfliction, integration with conventional forces that was more of teamwork than it was of one side leading the other or a sense of independence. It was really cooperative to support NATO.
In your view, how much did the UK platforms add to overall targeting capabilities? I mean, we certainly had lots of strategic, tactical, and theater nuclear weapons deployed throughout the Cold War. Was it necessary for our deterrent against Soviet conventional crises? Was that escalatory option necessary? Was it simply an addition to how central was this to the overall methods of strategic deterrence?
Again, at the strategic level, I can't really answer that question. I wasn't in that job position then. At the operational level, though, the UK dedicated system provided quite a bit, particularly in range. The U.S. weapon systems really looked at a strategic employment for very long-range targets. But the NATO planning packages, their capability for those missiles allowed you to have a longer reach for NATO than did any other systems. Because you're looking at field artillery, cannon-fired weapon systems, you're looking at rockets that have a relatively short range. You look at dual-capable aircraft, which have to be refueled. The UK missile systems really provide you the greatest amount of standoff in many cases, based upon the target set that you're trying to engage.
How were the relations, in terms of actual interpersonal relations, was it strictly professional? Did it become personal as well? I mean, I'm sure that, as you indicated, there was a tremendous amount of professionalism and cooperation. Interested in gaining any insight into how this relationship evolved, if you still keep in touch with any of these people. We've heard from other people about, they still exchange Christmas cards with some of their counterparts, It seems to say a lot about how that relationship evolved. Did you have any personal experience with that?
Oh, absolutely. You cannot have this level of cooperation, and I will even say teaming, that you don't develop some personal relationships. I would say for the most part, it's looked at very academic, collegial, and personal interfaces. So really all the three different levels. You can't work with folks as we have day in, day out, and not develop relationships. And so I think that also builds trust, the confidence, both in the professionalism and the person themselves. And so I think those relationships have flourished over time, and have not necessarily just been a short period of time for the interface. They do continue on past job assignments and changes in locations and And like that.
Were there ever any particular times where was the UK aware of the parameters of this relationship? Were there ever periods of time in which they asked questions in which you didn't know that you could provide them the answer, or that you knew you couldn't provide them the answer, or were they well aware sort of the boundaries of this relationship and were happy to work within it?
I think that they were very much aware of the boundaries and respected those, as we were aware of their boundaries and respected their own. And that helped a lot in the relationship, in building the two countries closer together in this arena, as opposed to trying to separate them by always wanting to know what the other party wasn't going to tell you. So I think both parties understood the boundaries, what they could and could not talk about, and respected those. And that helped the relationship as well.
This agreement was obviously signed 10 years before the non-proliferation treaty was signed, opened for signature. What is your sense for, could this agreement, this kind of cooperation, have occurred later in the Cold War? Was this necessary? Certainly, this occurred at a period where the Soviets were just in the beginning of building up their forces, just worked on their first ICBM the year before. Eisenhower, it seems, was interested in having the Europeans contribute significantly to their own defense, thinking about issues like the MLF and such. These all kinds of issues, particularly Eisenhower's belief about the Europeans wanting to defend themselves, contributed to this agreement. Do you think we could have gotten this kind of cooperation later in the Cold War? Was it necessary that it happened early on, before the Berlin Wall, before the Cuban Missile Crisis?
That's kind of tough to say. I would imagine the answer is yes, but really the relationship happened well before the Mutual Defense Agreement. That relationship has been around for, I don't know, for a very long time. But in the part of the nuclear weapons arena, if you will, it was really the encouragement by the UK. I think the guy's name was Mark Oliphant, that really convinced the United States to pay attention to what was going on in the world, that there was a lot of work being done by the French, the Italians, and particularly the Germans on fissionable products. And what that might mean as Europe was in World War II. And so it was really the UK that said, the United States needs to pay attention to what's going on. And through his efforts, I think the president realized that, did the commissioning of a special group to take a look at it, which was the genesis of the Manhattan Project, for which the UK and the US worked cooperatively together on the Manhattan Project. So it really had its origins, the UK-US relationship, much earlier on than even the Mutual Defense Agreement. So I think that's always been an ongoing tie. Had all that not happened, would we have come up with an agreement later on in the Cold War? The answer is, I think, yes, but I cannot imagine that it happening any later than what it already did. I think both parties understood the circumstances of the Cold War. It had already fostered the relationship during World War II under the Manhattan Project, and I think that's what solidified the necessity of the two nations to work cooperatively together, and also has set the basis for how we're going to continue to cooperate in the future, both in defense and non-proliferation and counter-proliferation type activities.
Actually leads into my next question, which is, how much has this particular agreement helped foster the relationship in other areas of foreign policy, both in terms of counterproliferation and non-proliferation, as well as perhaps in other economic, political areas as well? Do you think that this relationship, so central to UK security policy, has helped in other areas as well?
Indeed, it hasn't hurt, whether it's really been the core of all the relationships that have happened between the U.S. and U.K., I don't know. I would say that it has facilitated us moving forward in other areas of interest to both nations. particularly in the term in terms of nonproliferation and counterproliferation, where we are now extending our cooperation into detection. We're pursuing the potential for forensics, and that we are both intended on how do we preclude particularly a terrorist act of a rheological dispersal device or an improvised nuclear device getting into our countries. How do we detect the transit of illicit rheological materials? And so I think that the mutual defense agreement has helped through the course of time on building that relationship that allows us to do that today.
So there is ongoing cooperation with the UK, particularly on issues like nuclear forensics and detection. This is a joint effort.
Yes.
What is your view in terms of the UK's sole reliance on a sea-based strategic deterrent? Their recent defense white paper outlined a posture that relied solely on the Trident boats and largely on a minimum deterrent posture. Given the threats that they face and given our cooperation, how do you view that posture?
I think that they have done an evaluation that allows them, based upon some assurances from the United States as to what we're doing, allowed them to do that. How they might pursue their nuclear deterrent in the future is kind of hard to say at this point in time. This was the first decision that really allowed them to take a look at the platform itself, the submarine, which is a long-term procurement, development and procurement issue for them. They will have to take a look sometime in the future as to how do they maintain the nuclear weapon itself. And we have commitments from the United States to the UK that we have an obligation to share information and help into the cognitive process of deciding what kind of nuclear deterrent do we need in the future, given the uncertainty of how the world situation could potentially change.
Is a minimum deterrent posture similar to some of the other nuclear powers a sufficient deterrent, in your view, given the threats that they face? I mean, the United States certainly has a larger pool and requires a different mix of capabilities. Minimum deterrent posture tends to mean, purely second strike type of posture and mix between, counter value and semi-accurate counterforce capabilities. Is that a sufficient deterrent for the kind of threats that we may face together and separate?
It will be interesting to see how our nuclear posture review will turn out in the future. And I hope a lot of those questions that you posed, you'll get answers as we continue to take a look at it. But just some general thoughts on that is that one has to take a look at what does minimum security posture, particularly in the terms of nuclear, really mean? And is that an added benefit or is that potentially a negative? It makes a lot of difference as to the targeting policies of the country who has the nuclear forces. And the size of your stockpile, does that drive you to one targeting posture versus another targeting posture? And a lot depends on the balances of capabilities of the various players in the nuclear community and whether there's parity, non-parity, and really the overriding factor is capability because you never can judge intent. Intent on the use of nuclear weapons or any other tool of political power can change by an administration, can change by event. And so the way you can evaluate a threat is based upon capability. A concern that should be thought about as the posture review looks at the world situation is what type or size of stockpile do you need to be able to have flexibility in what you want to do in an uncertain future? One could conceive that you could get a stockpile sufficiently small enough that your only option is counter value, for which I think generally that would be a very bad position to be in. But if you only have a few, you have to make sure that you make the maximum impact for each one. And so each nation would have to decide as to what's really important for them, what are they trying to do with their weapons. But the key part is these weapons were designed to preclude their use. And so in many contexts, or many thoughts, you could say that these weapons are used every day. They fulfill their deterrent mission. And how do you ensure that they fulfill their deterrent mission for the future? And a lot of that will go into the calculus of how you look at, again, as I said, an uncertain future versus the capabilities of what other countries may have or may be developing. And I think that we will use our partnership with, like the UK, in helping us decide what is the right kind of deterrent posture, not only for us, but also goes into their decision-making process.
What has been, in your view, the general UK reaction to U.S. Initiatives for missile defense?
I'm not a missile defense guy, so I can't tell you.
Do you think that the relationship changed? You were sort of at an interesting time between the 80s, sort of late 80s and through the early 90s. So you essentially worked at the issue at the end of the tail end of the Cold War and then sort of in the beginning of the post-Cold War world. Did that relationship, do you think it's changed at all since the Cold War and with the demise of a common threat, so to speak, or a common, you know, looming threat, where nuclear weapons were a critical aspect? Did that relationship change in the early 90s at all, simply because we were trying to figure out what to do with nuclear weapons, what this relationship would look like? Then has it gone any sort of, has there been any peaks and valleys in this relationship since the end of the Cold War and even post 9/11?
Let's see. From my perspective, changes from the 80s, if you will, say the Cold War, to even today. From my perception, I think that they have strengthened. There's one where you leverage each's experiences and resources and such, but you really have indeed a sense of independence. You both are partners for the operational aspect. With the cessation of testing, though, I think that has made the cooperation much more needed. In that, how do you continue to certify a stockpile for which you can no longer test? And how do you do the analysis? How do you answer scientific questions that you did not have to answer before when you could test? You could make a design. You could take it down whole. You could test it. That was the final arbitrator as to whether the weapon design worked or didn't. So you didn't have to know all the things that necessarily went into the weapons design and material properties and such. Now it's very important. And now you're having to create the science-based stockpile stewardship program that allows you to look at all these material sciences issues that goes into certification without underground nuclear testing. It is always good to have another party doing calculations and verifying, confirming, or raising questions about what you've done when you go to try to certify without underground nuclear testing. It's an expensive project, one which we have done cooperation with the UK, and they're in the same dilemma as we are. Is how do you prove that a weapon will work and yet not demonstrate it? So I think those ties have strengthened. We were both faced with the same daunting questions of our stockpile as it continues to age.
As a deterrence theorist by training, I think about the relationship between credibility, opposed to capability and resolve, and also the logic of uncertainty. How much of the deterrent power is rests on uncertainty, if it's not certainty, and that, well, we cannot be sure that the weapon will work, neither can the adversary.
and the costs of being wrong, because these weapons are so big and so powerful, are so great that it doesn't take a whole lot of uncertainty for one to lack confidence in their ability to engage in war where nuclear weapons might be used. Does the uncertainty of whether or not the weapons work, whether or not they're gonna have the yield that they once had, enough to have that same potency of deterrence?
Well, let's see. I think that is will always be a question. The answer to that is in the mind of the beholder that is trying to ask themselves, do I feel lucky today? I think part of the confidence is that you could demonstrate to to another party, whether you want to say adversary or even through assurance that we provide extended deterrence, if you will, to other parties. You have to demonstrate that in some form or fashion that the stockpile is credible. You can do that in a variety of ways. First off is the credibility of the scientific and technical capabilities that a nation can bring forth that says we know what we're doing the right analysis, we're doing our homework, we're doing tests, although non-nuclear, we're doing experiments, we're doing calculations. We have some of the best and the brightest addressing these issues. That's one. The second one is that you have a variety of weapons in the stockpile. So you could say that I have question as to this particular one working because of aging issues, but there is also what we call reliability replacements that can substitute if we find a technical problem. Unfortunately, that does add to the stockpile size. The other part of credibility says that if we find a problem, that you have an infrastructure that can respond, it has been functioning, it knows how to produce a design and certify a weapon if we find a problem with the stockpile. And the last element that I would probably bring up is augmentation, is that as we continue to reduce our operational stockpile, the question is how do you account for or how do you mitigate the risk of changes, deleterious type changes in the geopolitical environment? So you have some number of weapons that, although small, that says I could augment my force if I thought it was really a problem. And you could do it within some specified period of time, hopefully within the decision loop of a potential adversary. That also does add some number of weapons to the size of the stockpile. But both in reliability and augmentation, those are looked at as means of mitigation to either technical or geopolitical risk and uncertainty.
In terms of looking, as you pointed out, deterrence is a psychological process that is really in the eye of the beholder. How much does the credibility of the stockpile influence the calculations of a variety of actors? Does it matter more to Russia and China than it does to a North Korea or a smaller power with a handful of nuclear weapons? I mean, you know, does, in terms of the credibility of the deterrent, does an adversary make the calculation that, well, they're not, I haven't seen enough scientific analysis to be able to be confident in their retaliatory capabilities? Does it matter at the size of the power, their stake in the world, their interests, which power has different capabilities to make those kind of calculations?
That's always difficult to really analyze. Not everyone thinks the same or does the same calculations that we do. And so the value judgments that we portray or believe another country may portray are biased. We have certain political objectives, but another nation or nation state or political leader may not evaluate, judge, weigh, calculate the options the way we would, because they have different objectives. That was actually kind of the nice part of the Cold War, is that we did have one type of monolithic adversary that you only really had to worry about how they perceived the world, and could we make sure that the world is in balance. Now we have a whole lot of different potential adversaries that you have to do the calculations on, all who have different interests in many respects for their own nation. And now you have non-state actors, which have also various interests that we may not even understand the calculations that they may use.
How much of this concern do you see, or do you have any sense for, with the UK? I mean, as we talked about size of the forces and flexibility within that force, do our other allies, particularly the UK, whom we have such a close cooperation with, hold the same views about deterrence and about the way in which we viewed the Cold War and the Soviet threat, in the way we view potential and emerging threats today? The white paper seemed to, at least in the public version, express reasonably high confidence in the potency of that deterrent. Our views about deterrence with respect to emerging threats, small states, resurgent Russia, modernizing China, terrorists, diverging in any way, in your view?
Well, that would really be a question for them. But from my perspective, of their perspective, I think they are very much attuned to each other, the U.S. view and the U.K. view. And I would say that's probably true with most Western nations, that says we need to have a deterrent of some number. You can't uninvent nuclear weapons. So how do you mitigate the potential risk of the future? And what risk do you put your own nation state in if you're wrong? On the other hand, if you judge that I need more than what you ever will, then you're also not effectively using the taxpayers' dollars and not and putting those dollars somewhere else. So it's it's quite a problem, as deciding how much is enough without having too much. Part of the dilemma is always, how do you be able to maintain critical skill sets? That goes back into that one piece that says, why do I believe your deterrent is a viable deterrent? So in some respects, you've got two competing issues. One is, how do I reduce the size of the nuclear stockpile? And the other one is, how do I maintain critical skill sets? And based upon critical skill sets, if you don't have them, then what's the value of your deterrent, or the confidence in the value of your deterrent?
How much is enough question is one that's plagued the defense planners since the early Cold War. I think of that. I got my start studying the history of nuclear strategy and reading that book by Alan Enthoven and Wayne Smith, mm-hmm. How Much is Enough, about the 60s. Really fascinating to see how they grappled with these kinds of issues and creating metrics for the assured destruction criteria and things like that. China is in the process of modernizing its forces, both the land-based mobile solid-fueled ICBMs as well as what has recently been shown in the public sphere, two, perhaps three, of the Type 094 SSBNs. I actually just gave a talk on this issue last week at one of the think tanks here in town on the potential strategic implications of that force. What are the implications both in thinking and using the UK experience of the move from basically an ICBM force to a sea-based deterrent. Of course, the UK has relied solely on that, is probably as it's concerned with its ultimate survivability. Do you think that China's making a similar calculation about the survivability of its force and moving to a sea-based deterrent? For that matter, is that the calculation that the UK used in deciding to rely solely on that kind of a deterrent force? You can pass on that if you want.
I'd love to pass on that, but I also feel obligated to at least provide some views on it a little bit. China. Well, if you take a look at what the United States has done, we have ICBMs that provide us quick response to an act of aggression. The submarine force provides us survivability to initial aggression. And the bomber force really provides the capability of making political statements public, and yet the capability of recall. I don't know, you might ask them, but I believe the Chinese also believe that they're looking at some capability for immediate response, which is a land-based systems, and looking at the credibility of having or assuring that they have a survivability of some number of assets as well. In the case of the UK and the US cooperation, I think that's one, my guess is that's probably one area for which we help each other out, and that the UK is indeed providing a deterrence in their own right. And yet through cooperation, we are able to look as to say how much is enough, who can do what, in what kind of circumstances. And so the mutual defense agreement is very important as to how can you trust in your allies. And so you really do look to see how much is enough, who can do what, and how do you maximize the resources that you have available. I don't know if anyone else would agree with that, but...
Let's finish up here, asking a couple more general questions about the future. One aspect of this was, as you know, Pony is part of creating a new generation of people thinking about these issues.
Mm-hmm.
Would you advise people getting into this work, both from a military perspective and a civilian perspective, to think about nuclear issues? Certainly, you know, if you were joining the Air Force throughout the Cold War, being a missile leader is a pretty good job. Doesn't seem to be a hot career anymore. Where do you think the future is going in this business? How will that affect U.S.-U.K. relations? Our future is going to evolve so similarly because we're so tied together.
I'd have to think about what your question really is for a second, but let's see. I think it's absolutely important which goes back into my support of Pony. I think it's absolutely necessary. Because I do not see nuclear coming off the table anytime soon. And it is important to have people, not only my generation, but the next follow-on generations, to be able to think about these critical issues of how do you look at the threat of nuclear weapons, whether it's from another state or non-state actors, and deterrent philosophies, strategies, and how do they apply. If we don't, it's like sticking your head into the sand and trying to hope that the problem goes away, and I don't see that happening. Nations do or pursue things that are in their best interest. If they pursue a neighboring country or some other country has superior conventional forces, the object is to either come up with mutual agreements or cooperation, doing heavy investments into balancing the conventional forces, or looking at other ways of counterbalancing conventional forces, which tends to be weapons of mass destruction. to include nuclear weapons. And the country is going to do what it needs to do to survive, which is through cooperation agreements or through assurance that it can survive attacks by some neighboring country. Those are issues that we face today, and I think those are issues that we're going to face in the future that the next generation is going to have to continue on and think about. PONY provides an excellent vehicle for doing that and trying to ensure the next generation is more than capable of taking on these big questions, or at least has the knowledge for taking on these big questions in the future.
Finally, coming near the end of our time, if you can
speak a little bit about how you think things might develop in the next administration, issues, you know, RNAP, RLW, ballistic missile defense, conventional strike, conventional trident, a lot of issues on the table. And for a very brief moment, these issues crept into the, you know, Democratic presidential debate, a little spat between Hillary Clinton and Obama about using nuclear weapons in Afghanistan. So these issues came up, you know, very briefly, but again, as you point out, they're always on the table. Can you comment on how you think these things should go? How should we be thinking about stockpile stewardship and some of the capabilities that began research and development over the last, you know, 7, 8, 10 years?
That could be very that could be a pretty good mind trap, right? I'll answer it in this way. I think that whatever administration, I believe that whatever administration is next, will take a look at the situation, become much more informed as to the activities that are going on, the significance of various activities, and pursue to do the right thing. It's kind of unfair in many aspects to ask a politician what they think, and yet they don't necessarily have all the resources that they can pull in that helps them answer the question that they're going to be confronted with if they take office. And so it's I think those are serious questions, and you can have beliefs which are fair, but once you're in the position, I think that the person is going to have to become very familiar with all the different questions that are being posed to them. And I believe that that person will take the right responsible actions. I'm a very optimistic person, but I'm a more of a technical guy, and so if you ask me about politics, it's kind of unfair because I'm not astute on politics. If I become learned in politics, I might change my opinion.
That'll be a great place to stop. Thank you very much for this fascinating discussion and your participation in this project.
You're welcome.
So, thank you.